Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the Cure Talks Cancer podcast. Each week, we'll be hearing from patients, survivors, caregivers, or healthcare professionals to do what Cure does best, provide cancer updates, research, and education. Sixty-three-year-old Colleen Johnson runs for more than just exercise. She runs for awareness. We spoke with Colleen about her recent 100-mile ultramarathon, where she wore a shirt with the number of women who died of endometrial cancer. We also heard how Colleen, a survivor herself, advocated for NCCN guidelines for the disease.
Can you tell me a little bit about your experience with endometrial cancer and kind of what was your life like from a health standpoint leading up to your diagnosis?
I took a path to endometrial cancer that is really common among women. I started off with something called polycystic ovary syndrome, which is where your ovaries develop cysts. This throws off hormonal balance in your body. It causes a woman to have too much estrogen and too little progesterone. It also tied closely in with polycystic ovary syndrome is insulin resistance. And when you have insulin resistance, your pancreas starts to create higher levels of insulin. As you have higher levels of insulin, one side effect of this is that when you have higher levels of insulin, you put on weight. Now we have a situation where there's high levels of estrogen, low levels of progesterone, high levels of insulin, which turn around and add weight, encourages obesity. Now, fat cells create estrogen. A lot of people don't realize that, but fat cells themselves can create estrogen. So the more weight you put on, the more estrogen you're going to have in your system, not only created by the ovaries, but also now created by the fat cells. The higher the estrogen levels get in your body, the lower the progesterone levels in your body, the higher the insulin levels in your body, the greater the risk of developing endometrial cancer. It's not the only way that women develop endometrial cancer, but one really common method is to develop polycystic ovary syndrome, then insulin resistance, then type 2 diabetes, and then finally endometrial cancer. Obviously, those are some of the risk factors for endometrial cancer, and they were the factors that were in my history, but some other risk factors for endometrial cancer includes being diagnosed with either breast or ovarian cancer, also family history of endometrial or colon cancer is another risk factor. Now, these weren't risk factors for me, but they are risk factors for other ladies.
So you're clearly very well-informed on this topic. When you were first diagnosed, was there a lot of information readily available? Did you already know much about the disease? And how did you kind of educate yourself to be as, you know, knowledgeable as you are now?
I had never heard of endometrial cancer or uterine cancer by either name. In fact, I went to the doctor at age 57, 2 days after my 57th birthday, and I went to the doctor asking him why I had never hit menopause. See, I was still bleeding. I never quit bleeding. And I thought I was just late hitting menopause. And that was a question I was asked to get answered. Mm-hmm. I was really shocked when he came back and said, "It's not an issue of menopause, ma'am. You have endometrial cancer." And I had to ask him, what the clock is endometrial cancer? I had never heard of it. I did not know what it was. They sent me home with just a sheet of paper that had the word endometrial on it so I could get on the web later and research it. I would know how to spell it. There wasn't much information out there. The American Cancer Society had information about endometrial cancer, just like they do all cancers. And that was about the only quality information that was out there. And it wasn't enough for a person who's just been told they have high-risk endometrial cancer and they have only a 25% chance of living 3 years, 20% chance of living 5 years. You want to have a little bit more information than just what the American Cancer Society's website offered. And there wasn't hardly anything else out there. Most of the websites would just lift the words off of the American Cancer Society website and then they post them as if they wrote them themselves. So I wasn't finding a lot of information at the intermediate level. I found, the beginning level overview at the American Cancer Society website. I couldn't find anything at the intermediate level for endometrial cancer the way it exists for other cancers. So what I ended up having to do in the end was I had to start reading actual research articles that are written for other scientists and cancer researchers, and I actually got an entire textbook on uterine cancer and read all but one chapter that just did not pertain to me. And that was too much information, but I had to in order to get enough information to try to know what I should do for myself. And at the same time, I started running into a lot of information. It wasn't specific to endometrial cancer, but I started running into a lot of information that was documenting the benefits of weight loss, diet, and a regular, vigorous exercise program for cancer patients. And to my surprise, I actually ran across two clinical studies, one with breast cancer patients and one with colon cancer patients. And in both of these studies, the conclusion was that patients who lost weight if they needed to, ate a healthy diet, and engaged in regular and vigorous exercise programs, that these patients could actually slow the return of even aggressive cancers. Now, I had an aggressive cancer. It wasn't colon or breast cancer. It was endometrial cancer. But I had an aggressive cancer. If that worked for breast cancer, might it work for endometrial cancer? It was worth a shot. I don't know that I really believed it would work when I first took that route. But I didn't feel like I had anything to lose.
Right.
Except maybe a little bit of unwanted fat. So I decided that I would go on a 1,500-calorie weight reduction diet, and I would adopt a regular and vigorous exercise program. Wasn't sure it would help, but I didn't figure it would hurt. I am actually surprised that nearly 6 years later that I'm still alive. They said I wouldn't be. It looks like it actually helped.
You got into this exercise regimen, which is great. What ultimately made you take the step and say, I'm going to run 100 miles to raise awareness? And how was training for that?
Well, first of all, you have to realize I wasn't always a runner. Before I was 58 years old, I never did any running other than running away from exercise. That was it. At 58 years old, I started to run 5Ks, 3.1-mile races.
Okay.
My first one was in 2013. In the beginning, it was just strictly to, it was part of my regular vigorous exercise program that I was trying to do in order to maybe live a little bit longer. But what ended up happening, I took to running. And I trained for a 5K, but 22 days after my first 5K, I ended up doing a half marathon. And then 5 months after my first half marathon, I ended up doing my first full marathon. At age 61, I learned of a race that where it would be possible for me to be able to run 100 miles. And I decided that was a good way to raise awareness of uterine cancer. I'm probably the last person you would expect to run a 100-mile race, and yet I've done it for 3 years now. And I decided to do a 100-mile race because it's something most people would never have the courage to even attempt. Mm-hmm. Even people younger and healthier than me don't usually run distances that long. I mean, that's almost the distance of 4 marathons back to back.
Wow.
Women with endometrial cancer are forced behind a wall of silence. We are definitely given the message that no one wants to hear our stories. And this is a real problem. You know, no one wants to hear about uterine cancer. And if we try to tell our story, they'll walk off or they'll tune out. But people are, for whatever the reason, they are interested in 60-something-year-old cancer survivors who will run 100 miles. And so it becomes a vehicle for trying to get the word out about uterine cancer.
How long did it take you to run 100 miles? About how long does it take each race?
I sleep and I eat, and I take time off, so I don't run it continuously.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it took me around 60 hours to do it this year.
Okay.
I don't know my exact time, to be honest with you. It's on the net.
Mm-hmm.
I just haven't had time to look it up yet. About 60 hours, but I would run nights, and then I would sleep during the day, and I'd eat during the day.
Okay. And you wore a special T-shirt on the race day that exemplified the number of people who died from endometrial cancer. Can you tell me a little bit about why you decided to kind of wear that bold statement and where you got that idea from?
Oh, my race shirt is an integral part of what I do, actually. The front of it reads, from cancer to marathon, fighting my cancer 1 mile at a time. Now, that's my story. And honestly, if you go back into the history of my running, when I first started running in 2013, the reason I put that front on my shirt was because I was afraid of everybody laughing at me when I ran. I mean, I'm an old lady, and I'm not exactly the best runner on this planet, not by a long shot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really worried about just being laughed at. And I thought, well, if I put that message, maybe they won't laugh at me. Now, what I didn't realize is that things had changed from when I was a young person. When I was a young person, well, for one thing, women weren't allowed to run marathons at all back then. But you weren't allowed to run a race if you weren't a really excellent runner. Even as a male, you weren't allowed to run a race unless you were an excellent runner. And so a person like me that would be older and running and who wouldn't be all that great at it, in the 60s and the 70s when I was a kid, you'd be laughed at. They might even try to trip you or throw things at you. They could be pretty cruel back then. I was trying to protect myself from that. Well, that was the original story behind that, the front of that shirt. But something developed over time, and I didn't see it coming until it happened. People were looking at that shirt, and they were watching me not just run 5Ks, but run half marathons, run full marathons, eventually get into the world of ultra run, marathon running. And they were thinking, you know, if she can do it, something that difficult, maybe I can do whatever I need to do to improve my own life. And so I started having people come to me and say, you know, I know your story, and I thought, if you could lose weight, I could lose weight. So I went on a diet, and I lost weight. Or they'd say, you know, if you could run a marathon, I thought, maybe I could do it. And so I trained for it, and guess what? I did it. And some of the stories were even, I had one lady, for example, who came up to me and said that she always wanted to go back to college, but she was afraid that she couldn't do it. And she looked at me and she said, you know, if you could beat cancer and then do all these runs, maybe I could succeed at going back to college. Mm-hmm. And so she went back to college second semester. It was during her second semester that she mentioned that to me.
Yeah.
People were taking inspiration from my story, and I didn't expect that. And it was because of the front of the shirt. Now, the back of the shirt is the part of the shirt I've always considered to be the more important part of the shirt. It's my memorial to the ladies that aren't as fortunate that I am, as I have been. I started running in the year 2013. Now, that's just 5 years ago. My very first shirt said, the back of it said, in memory of the 8,190 ladies who will die this year of endometrial cancer, because that was the official number that the American Cancer Society projected would die of endometrial cancer in that year. Every year I have had to get my shirts reprinted because that number keeps going higher and higher and higher. It is skyrocketing. It went in 5 short years from 8,190 expected deaths due to uterine cancer to 11,360 in just 5 years.
Wow.
That's a 28% increase in the number of ladies dying of endometrial cancer in just 5 years. Now, the American Cancer Society is very quick to remind us that research saves lives. Well, they're right about that. The problem is that there's very little research being done on uterine cancer. There were some researchers that went back into the records of the National Cancer Institute. Now, that's the National Cancer Institute is the primary source of federal funding for research in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
For the different types of cancer. There were some researchers that went back and looked at where they were delegating their money. Because it's a matter of public record. You just have to have the time to do it. These researchers went back and looked at every dollar that the National Cancer Institute gave for the 13 most common cancers found in the United States. And they looked at it for the years 2007 through 2014. What they found, and it was consistent in every year that they looked at, what they found was, in general, the gynecological cancers were underfunded research-wise compared to other cancers. But then they found that even among the gynecological cancers, uterine cancer was getting the least amount of money for the number of women that are affected by the cancer. And it was a really dramatic lack of funding. And so, you know, we have had a 56% increase in the number of ladies dying of endometrial cancer between the years 2000 and 2015. Now, 2015 is the last year for which you have concrete death data available through the Centers for Disease Control. 56% increase during that time. And this is at a time when deaths due to other cancers has been going down. Deaths due to cancers that are getting a lot of research funds, going down. Mm-hmm. Deaths due to uterine cancer, which is being grossly underfunded, the research is being grossly underfunded, our death rates are going sky high. Research saves lives. It definitely does. And the fact that they're not doing research for endometrial cancer, I believe, is a lot of the reason why our death rates are skyrocketing right now. You know, and so you ask me, well, why did you do 100, why did you ever decide to do a 100-mile race? Well, that's the reason. Look, I'm just a single person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have money. I don't have political influence. But what I do have, I have my running shoes. I have my special race shirt, and I have a willingness to do something very few people would be willing to do. I am willing to run or walk 100 miles in a single race. That's almost a distance of 4 marathons,
right,
back to back, to try and raise awareness of the needs of the ladies with endometrial cancer. And it needs to be done. We are seeing too many ladies die.
So I guess that kind of leads into my next question, is that you advocated for the establishment of NCCN guidelines for this patient population. What inspired you to do that? And tell me a little bit about that journey, pushing for these guidelines.
I don't know that my role was really all that important in the process. The folks at the NCCN are the ones that really worked hard to make those guidelines happen for the ladies with endometrial cancer. I was in contact with the executive director, and I pointed out to her how badly we needed them, how badly I needed them back in 2012 when I was trying to find information out about my cancer, trying to figure out what I needed to do to treat, you know, what treatments I needed to go through, what I needed to do to save my life. Like I said, you know, there was this simplistic information at the American Cancer Society website, which was good, but it was, you know, it didn't go into as much detail as I needed. And the only thing I had was to available to me was to jump into actual medical literature. There was nothing in between. And that added a level of stress and anxiety that just didn't have to be there. I mean, I was always afraid that I was going to miss that one piece of information that I needed in order to save my life.
Right.
The NCCN guidelines are that exist. They're just very high quality. They offer a lot more information for someone who's trying to find their way through this maze that's called cancer treatment. It was too late for me, obviously, but when I found the NCC guidelines for other cancers, I realized that's exactly what I needed. And so I reached out to them, and I told them my story. I told them how much their guidelines meant to people with other types of cancer, and how much they could have meant to me if I had had them back in 2012. And here's the thing, how much they could benefit ladies today who are being newly diagnosed.
Right.
You can't change the past, but you can change the present. And I was really surprised at how receptive they were to what I was saying. They listened and responded. This is their part in what it's going to take to help break down the wall of silence that surrounds endometrial cancer. And I'm really appreciative of what they've done.
Great. So I guess as a final wrap-up, moving forward, what kind of change would you like to see in the endometrial cancer space? And what role do you think you can continue to play in that change?
Well, the wall of silence that surrounds endometrial cancer has got to come down for anything else to happen for these ladies. We are the only cancer that does not have a foundation at the national level to speak up for us and to fight for research dollars in our behalf. We need to have a foundation that represents our interests. I'm going to continue to run races, and I'm going to continue to speak out, trying to get somebody who can help make that happen. We need for individual cancer centers to set up support groups that are especially for women with gynecological cancer, because we're basically being told to keep quiet. No one wants to hear our stories. We need to talk just like everybody else does. We have special needs that no other type of cancer has. We need to be able to strengthen each other. We need to be able to learn from each other. We need to be able to hug each other.
Right.
And the cancer clinics around the nation, they offer this service to other types of cancers. My cancer clinic, for example, offers this service to not only breast cancer patients, but prostate cancer, brain cancer, head and neck cancer, blood cancers. It's all kinds of cancers that they offer this to.
Mm-hmm.
Cancer clinics across the nation offer this service to people with other types of cancer. We in the gynecological cancer community need this service as much as anybody else does.
Mm-hmm.
But very few clinics are offering service to their gynecological patients at this time. It forces us into isolation. We have to fight our cancers alone. It's part of that wall of silence that I'm talking about. And we've got to find a way to break through that wall of silence so that people talk about endometrial cancer, so they know what it is, so that they're finally willing to send resources in the direction of the ladies that have endometrial cancer. I'm going to continue to run, and I'm going to continue to speak out for these ladies, because there are very few people that are doing that at this time.
Great. All right, is there anything else you'd like to mention?
Well, the one thing that I didn't mention that most people don't realize is that the American Cancer Society estimates there are 700,000 currently living survivors of uterine cancer in the United States. That actually makes us the second largest group of female cancer survivors in this country.
Join us next week when we speak with Elizabeth Langdon, Vice President of Strategic Communications and Development for the Head and Neck Cancer Alliance, as she discusses what the organization does and how it can help with screening, challenges, and patient support platforms for those with head and neck cancer.
The Cure Talks Cancer Podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, the indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com and find us on Twitter at @cure_magazine.